Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We begin by going to Spain, a country that has been hit hard by COVID-19. Spain has more than 157,000 cases. Almost 16,000 people have died. Spain lost 605 people today. That is the lowest number of COVID-19 deaths in more than 2 weeks. But the country's health minister says they are not in a de-escalation phase, and the strict lockdown will continue for another 2 weeks. Joining us with the latest is Stephen Bergen, a freelance journalist and contributor to The Guardian. Stephen has been based in Barcelona for 20 years and has been writing about all aspects of Spain's political, social, and cultural life. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for joining us. Well, how are you and your friends doing? I just spoke with a friend who lives in Barcelona this morning, and she said, other than watching the news, everyone is inside. You can only go out for grocery store shopping. So, you know, that's where she's getting her updates. How are you and your family doing?
Well, it's you know, when we look at lockdown in other countries, and we think, a lot of us say, well, that's not a lockdown. I mean, We in the last month, I've probably left the house maybe six times to shop, and that's it. And when I go out, there's nobody or virtually nobody in the street, very few people in the market or the supermarket, and there are people who are there. I mean, remarkably, it's been very, very disciplined in this country. The few people who are out are wearing masks, they're maintaining social distance. A lot of things that you wouldn't associate with Spain are, you know, a collective discipline is probably not something we're famous for here. But no, it's very, very strict. You know, I talk to my friends in England and they say, oh, well, I went out for a walk or I went out for a jog. And, well, we're not allowed to do that. And we haven't, this is, I think, day 27 of lockdown. And they're talking about maybe next week allowing people with children to take them out. But as you said at the beginning, the numbers are going down and it seems to be working. But everyone's afraid, or the government's afraid of jumping the gun and letting people off the leash too soon. And finding that there's another spike in infection.
You know, when we first started reporting on this, we were focused so much on Italy because their cases are so incredibly high. And then we started seeing Spain in news and the numbers are very high. How did Spain end up with so many cases and so many people dying from COVID-19?
Well, I don't think a proper analysis has been done of this yet, but I suspect there are two factors. One is that both countries have large elderly populations. And we do have both here in Italy, you know, a frighteningly high number of deaths, but 70 to 80% of them are people aged over 70. And the other thing is that we are, we're very sociable. You know, most people here and in Italy would visit their parents or their grandparents once a week. On Sunday, there would be a family dinner. You know, the family is the central, you know, organizing factor, the central social factor in Mediterranean life. And so, you know, when at the time when people were infectious but not aware of it, there was probably a lot more contact between people who were carriers and particularly the elderly than there might be in a culture like the United States or Northern Europe, where the family is not so fundamental.
You wrote a recent piece in The Guardian called Poor and Vulnerable Hardest Hit by the Pandemic. And you look at how the poor and marginalized people have been disproportionately impacted. Just overall, I mean, we're now in the United States just really learning about how this is hitting, you know, communities of color the hardest, especially Black communities. We're still in the learning stages in the United States, but what are you learning about marginalized communities in Spain?
Well, I think that, you know, partly we wrote that as a reaction to this fallacy that it's, you know, the virus is a great leveler and, you know, it doesn't distinguish between rich and poor and so on. And, you know, this is obviously not true because, you know, as we point out in the article, the people who are on the front line, not so much in hospitals, because not everyone in the hospital is a doctor. There are all sorts of people who do menial jobs who are poorly paid, plus the people who have to keep the supermarkets running, have to keep public transport running, and so on. These are mostly people, they're working class people in often low status, badly paid jobs, who therefore have a higher exposure to the infection because they're not in quarantine at home. And then when they get home, they tend to live in smaller spaces, and the possibility of them self-isolating within their family group or their is much less. And so the likelihood of them, first of all, catching the virus and then passing it on is much higher than people who are basically wealthier and have many more options for, first of all, avoiding the virus, and secondly, for avoiding passing it on if they get it. And the third aspect, of course, is that poor people have more health problems. And, we know that the virus is much more virulent with people who have underlying health problems. And obviously, there's a vicious cycle between poverty and health. And so this is another factor.
Right. You refer to an interactive map produced by the Catalan regional government showing the distribution of the virus reveals that residents of poor neighborhoods in Barcelona are 6 or 7 times more likely to contract the virus than those in wealthy neighborhoods.
Correct.
Right. How, is this getting much attention in the media in Spain? Are people talking about this?
No, not particularly. I think that particular aspect is there hasn't been a lot of focus. What there has been a lot of focus on is the disastrous and, dare I say, scandalous impact of the virus in old people's homes, both public and private ones, where it's clear that the lack of facilities, the lack of protection for staff and for patients has meant that there's been, I think in Madrid alone there were 3,000 deaths in care homes. Here in Barcelona, I think it's 1,500. These are people where, people have put their elderly relatives to be cared for, often at great expense, and they're dying like flies. It's really quite an appalling scenario, and we're starting to see the same in other countries, particularly the UK.
And Stephen, as you know, in the United States, we do not have universal health care. What kind of health care system is in Spain? And how is it working?
The healthcare system in Spain is fantastic. It's been said that we have the economy of Ireland and the healthcare system of Switzerland. It is extremely good, very high quality, and it's all free at the point of service. And I think the scary thing about what's happening. I was talking to a doctor about this recently. Is that because all of the attention is now focused on dealing with this virus, that when this finally dies down, we're going to have an enormous backlog of people who have ongoing conditions that haven't been treated, heart conditions, cancer, and so on, people who have been waiting for operations. There's going to be an enormous backlog, and one of the problems that we face now, one of the reasons that we face this complete overload, is that successive governments have cut back on spending in public health and have tried to sort of cut it back to the minimum, and which is why quite simple things like not having enough masks or gowns, that's the result of these cuts. And we're going to have to see a big change in political will in order to bring it up to scratch to deal with not with the coronavirus but with everyone who hasn't been treated for what will probably have been 2 months.
Wow. So as it stands, and that is such an interesting question to find out what's going to happen in the coming months as people, learn that they need care for many types of issues. But right now in Spain, people can get tested and treated free of charge?
In theory, but I don't know anyone. I know quite a few people who have got the virus, and I don't know anyone who's been tested. As far as I can tell, up until now, the only people who get tested are people who are admitted to hospital, or, you know, members of the government, but, you know, they don't really, that's not a significant number. There hasn't been any, they keep saying there's going to be, but there hasn't been any mass testing of people either to see if they're infected or using the antigen test to see if they're now, they've now got immunity, which would mean, you know, economically, you know, obviously everyone wants, you know, we need to get back to work as soon as possible or, you know, things are going to go from bad to worse. But we can't start sending people who are asymptomatic carriers back into society, or we're going to end up in a worse state. So the testing issue, and not just in Spain, but, you know, absolutely everywhere with the possible exception of South Korea, is the issue. You know, until we can say, obviously, until we have a vaccine, but that's a long way down the road, until we can say reliably, this person has got immunity and they can go back into safely into society and not either catch or pass on the virus, then it's very difficult. And this is what the government's grappling with. I mean, they're saying, as of Monday, that non-essential workers, like construction workers, for example, can go back to work, but because we're seeing the numbers go down. But if the numbers could go back up again, and personally, I think if the numbers go back up and they've relaxed the very strict lockdown that we've lived in for the past month, that cranking it back up will be very difficult because people will, you know, people have been very disciplined and been very correct about observing it. But you know how it is, you give people, you know, take them an inch and they'll take a mile, and people are going to feel, no, I'm not going back to that. So it's a very difficult decision for the government. It's a very hard, tough hand to play.
Right. Every government is going to have to make that decision. And let's talk for a minute about doctors and nurses, because 12,000 healthcare workers have tested positive in Spain. And according to The Lancet, the situation in part reflects existing staff shortages, as you said, following years of austerity with low salaries. What are you hearing from doctors and nurses? We've seen a lot of videos of doctors and nurses in Spain who are stretched to the point of mental and physical exhaustion.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true. There's been that's correct, as far as I know, that there's sort of 12 or 15% of all frontline medical staff have become infected. Some of them have been probably gone back to work when they were still contagious. They've been recruiting people who've, you know, retired doctors and nurses. Nurses and doctors who haven't actually finished their course, who are in their last year of training. And, you know, I think we're sort of moving beyond the frontline crisis of intensive care. It happens that as I look out my window, I look out at a 5-star hospital that for the past 2 weeks has been a 5-star hotel, I should say, that for the past 2 weeks has been an isolation hospital. And a few days ago, it was absolutely packed. And now there are fewer lights on. I think, you know, we're passing, you know, this much talked about flattening of the curve. I think we're near it. The danger is relaxing too much and seeing it go up again.
Today, we are speaking with Stephen Bergen, a freelance journalist and contributor to The Guardian. Stephen has been based in Barcelona for 20 years. And if you have any questions for Stephen about what is happening in Spain, if you have any connections to Spain or have friends or family there, and you've spoken to them recently and you'd like to share their stories, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Stephen, let's talk about how this is affecting workers and small business owners. I mean, here in the States, 16 million people have already applied for unemployment. Small businesses are suffering to get loans and grants. Right now in Spain, the unemployment rate is just under 14%, which is more than double the EU, while youth unemployment is at 30%. So what are you hearing from people who've lost their jobs and have had to close their small businesses?
Well, it's going to be tough. I think Spain has had we've had effectively 10 years more of recession since the financial crash in 2008. We just have been the last few years being able to, you know, pick up a bit from that. But, one factor is that since that time, the amount of people with real jobs has declined. Unemployment at the height of the crisis was 25%. And so we're now down somewhere 12 or 14%. But a lot of those people who are not on the unemployment books do not have real jobs. They have temporary contracts. Possibly, according to trade unions, 90% of the jobs created in 2019 were temporary, which means contracts lasting between 2 and 40 days. So these people are extremely vulnerable. And many of these people have jobs that are related to the hospitality industry. 12% of Spain's GDP is based on tourism. And I mean, last year, I think, to remember rightly, 82 million tourists came to this country. That's nearly twice the population of the country. Now, I mean, here in Barcelona, obviously, this is a city that depends very heavily on tourism. And there is nobody here, and I mean nobody. There are, you know, we've been saying for years we'd like fewer tourists, but now we've gone a bit, you know, careful what you wish for. We've now got no one. There are many, many bars and restaurants, possibly hotels, that will not be able to survive this crisis. And those people, that industry employs, accounts for a very large amount of low-wage jobs, waiters, chambermaids, and so on. And all of these people obviously are out of work, and lots of them do not have contracts. So they are not going to be bailed out by the government. And I fear there's going to be a massive rise of unemployment and with that, homelessness, which is already a large problem here. How the economy is going to recover, I mean, because we're, you know, in many ways a service economy, apart from agriculture and a few things. Other things, it's very largely a service economy, and tourism accounts for, I think, 12% of the whole nation's GDP. It's a lot of money. And this is an industry that is about to recover overnight. In fact, I mean, here in Barcelona, the people in the tourist industry are saying that we've basically written off 2020 and we're looking ahead to 2021. I think the economic ramifications are going to be severe for absolutely everybody, including people like me, freelance journalists, because, you know, the people who I work for are also, you know, everyone's suffering a massive loss of income.
Well, let's talk about what is the government doing specifically for workers. You know, a number of people in the States have been posting articles about the government in Spain planning to implement some kind of universal basic income as soon as possible. Can you tell us about that?
The thing people, basically, a lot of that derives from a misquote. I mean, it's not that the government is discussing universal basic income. The relevant minister was quoted saying we're discussing this, and somebody along the line interpreted this as we're implementing it. And then, as is the nature with the internet, everyone followed that saying they are not immediately going to implement a national basic income. There's obviously, given the precariousness of many, many people's employment in this country, that would make a lot of sense. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, a southern European country that is, you know, is economically weak and was severely weakened by the crash of 2007-08, particularly because much of the strength of the economy at that time was based on a building boom. And as you know from the same experience in the U.S., that when a building, a housing bubble bursts, many, many people lose their jobs. And that's what happened here. And, you know, it is, we're not Germany, we're not France. We don't have a very strong economy. And I think really, eyes are on Brussels to come up with some sort of significant rescue package, because there's no way that Spain has the economic resources to dig itself out of the post-coronavirus hole on its own, in the foreseeable future. Sorry to say, it sounds very doomsday-ish, but I think that's how it is.
No, I mean, this is what so many countries are dealing with. And I think that people are, very desperate for solutions. And so when we see one, people post it without, knowing what's really going on. And so I'm glad you're giving us the context around universal basic income. What about small businesses? What sort of help is available for them, for small business owners?
Well, they're offering tax holidays, various concessions like that, which aren't so much like direct financial support as, it's one thing not having to pay your rent for a few weeks. That's another actually being given cash. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is cash available. But again, I think something like 90% of the businesses in Spain are small businesses. That's people who employ fewer than 25 people. So it's a very large part of the business picture here. I mean, perhaps it is in other countries, I don't know, but it is, I know, in Germany, for example. And I think, most of these people, they're not going to be able to sustain the employment levels. One of the things that's happened, there's a thing here that's called a temporary redundancy deal, which is you have a restaurant, you have 10 employees. You can right now file for this, and the government will pay their wages for the next 6 months, or 80% of their wages, I think, for the next 6 months. But when all this is over and they come back to work, under the deal is you, as a person who owns a restaurant, have an obligation to employ these people for at least another 6 months. Well, I mean, on one level, that seems perfectly fair, but as one person who runs a bunch of restaurants here said to me, well, we don't know how much business we're going to have because, as I was saying earlier, the tourists aren't going to suddenly return just like that. It'll take a long time and probably will be years before it returns to the sort of figures before. So these people have a commitment to pay salaries that will be, not commensurate with the sort of incomes they're getting from running a restaurant, for example.
And before we let you go, Stephen, you brought up journalists earlier. How are reporters in Spain doing? How has this affected media? I mean, in the United States, unfortunately, we're seeing people lose their jobs. We're seeing reporters go on furlough. What are you seeing?
Well, everyone's stuck at home and everyone's reading newspapers networks of one kind or another, but are they paying for them? I mean, most of the media in this country is not behind a paywall. It's starting to go behind a paywall, but it's at the moment it's hesitated because I think it's obviously people need information. That's not a good time to start asking people for money. I think it's going to be like every other industry. I think this coronavirus is going to make life for people in the media harder than it already was. And as you know, it was hard enough.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Best to you and your family and loved ones. And we'd love to have you back soon.
Okay. Thanks. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. You too. That is Stephen Bergen, a freelance journalist and contributor to The Guardian. He has been based in Barcelona for 20 years. You can find the piece he recently wrote, Poor and Vulnerable, Hardest Hit by Pandemic in Spain, at yourcallradio.org. And we just got some breaking news from the Los Angeles Times. The number of confirmed global deaths related to COVID-19 has now reached 100,000. This is according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins. The United States has the world's largest reported outbreak by far, with more than 450,000 cases, nearly 17,000 deaths, including more than 5,100 in New York City alone. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Reveal's Will Carlos about one of his latest pieces. California created a massive medical reserve with acute care beds, ventilators, and N95 masks, and then let it collapse. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington, a report on the thousands of people in hundreds of countries applauding the sacrifices being made by healthcare workers. The latest from around the world, coming up at 11.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Joining us now is Will Carlos. Will is a correspondent for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Will and his colleagues, Will Evans and Lance Williams, are out with a piece, California created a massive medical reserve with acute care beds, ventilators, and N95 masks, and then let it collapse. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great to have you, Will. Nice to hear your voice. First off, how are you doing? How are you and your loved ones doing?
I'm doing okay. I moved, actually. I used to live in Brazil. I think the last time I spoke to you was when I was living in Rio de Janeiro in a little apartment. And I'm now in Southern California, and I'm kind of glad I am, to be honest, because, you know, although this country is kind of not doing a great job sort of dealing with this pandemic, I'd rather be here than in Rio, because I do trust the American government, particularly the California government, despite this story, a little more than I trust the Brazilian authorities to do their job properly.
Well, would you like to say anything about what's happening in your old home, Will? Because I'm sure you're still in touch with contacts there.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I think most of your listeners have probably heard the you know, frankly, nonsense that's being talked by the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro. He has sort of become the go-to sort of denier-in-chief, I guess, these days. He's, you know, continuing to say that the virus is not a big deal, that nobody should really worry about it. He's having very public and open spats with his health minister, who I believe he fired a couple of days ago. And he's essentially just kind of blustering around and saying this isn't a big deal. Meanwhile, thankfully, the governors, the state governors and municipal mayors and other local leaders have essentially told their populations not to listen to him and to go into lockdown and to, you know, be careful about social distancing and not spreading the virus and everything else. And so thankfully, he's largely being ignored. Even one of the most interesting anecdotes I heard was that in the big favelas, the big disorganized communities in places like Rio and São Paulo and other cities in Brazil, the narco traffickers, who are de facto the bosses of, you know, they're in charge of these communities, have actually come out and they've ordered lockdowns in open defiance of the president, and have sort of said, you know, regardless of what Bolsonaro says, you better stay in your homes, you better stay locked down and exercise social distancing, otherwise you've got us to deal with. So yeah, it's a bit of a mess, luckily I think common sense is prevailing despite the noises coming from the top.
Wow. Well, this NBC headline says it all. Brazil's doctors fight coronavirus while they struggle with Bolsonaro every day. So we will definitely have a reporter from Brazil on. Maybe you can give us a recommendation after the show, Will, so we can talk about what's going on in Brazil. Okay. Thank you so much. Now, Will, you and your colleagues wrote a really important story about what's going on in California, because for obvious reasons, we're so focused on what's happening now. But I have been wondering, you know, what is the deal with California and the lack of PPE? What's the history behind this? So how did you all go about really looking at how we got to this point?
So Will Evans and I kind of came at this story from different angles. Will was specifically pulling on a thread and looking into this this fund and this stockpile that we had. He knew it was about, he found a source who was the guy who previously ran it, who recently retired, who was, you know, who was talking and being very frank about his opinions about what happened to it ultimately. I, meanwhile, had been investigating the ventilator industry. So I was talking to a lot of sort of secondhand ventilator dealers who are, who do exist, and they're out there. There is a huge market for sort of used secondhand medical equipment. And, excuse me, a couple of the people I was talking to were saying, look, the story you need to look at is the big state stockpiles that were sold off after a few years. And so Will Evans and I both sort of came across this story. I was specifically looking at the ventilator side of things, medical ventilators. I knew from the sources I was speaking to that California had bought a couple of thousand ventilators back in late 2008, 2009, and that it subsequently just donated them, gave them away to hospitals because the maintenance costs were too high to keep them going. And Will, meanwhile, was reporting out the other side of this, which is it wasn't just the ventilators. It was the N95 masks. It was the mobile field hospitals. It was all the other equipment that California had sort of very smartly stashed up for exactly this sort of situation we're in now, was essentially thrown out of the window because of the budget cuts that came along in 2011 when California was facing a huge budget deficit.
So the other thing that we learn in your piece is that in 2006, citing the threat of the avian flu, then Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger announced that the state would invest hundreds of millions of dollars in a powerful set of medical weapons to deploy in the case of large-scale emergencies and natural disasters, so like fires and earthquakes and pandemics. And Governor Schwarzenegger at the time said that in light of the pandemic flu risk, it is absolutely a critical investment. I'm not willing to gamble with the people's safety. So tell us more about that reasoning and why he decided to invest, what was it, $200 million in disaster preparedness at that time?
Yeah, a little more than that. This is such a classic California story, and I'm sure, you know, everybody listening to this can kind of, you know, level with this. It's just, no matter what you follow in this state, whether it's the real estate market or education or, you know, public health or the police departments, we just are in a constant boom and bust, right? I mean, when we're either rolling in money or we're broke. I mean, that's just how the state works. And in 2006, the state was rolling in money. And so one of the things that Governor Schwarzenegger, I think, very wisely chose to do was to build up this stockpile. Now, a lot of people are saying now, well, we could never have foreseen this. We could have never have foreseen that such a big thing would happen. That's nonsense. Epidemiologists have been warning for decades of exactly a pandemic like this or worse. This isn't the first pandemic. It's not going to be the last. And so when states are flush with money, when they've got extra cash to throw around, they can do things like go out and build up stockpiles for the future. Unfortunately, because of the way that California's, you know, income stream works, 2 years later or 3 years later, we're broke and we're desperately looking for ways to save money. So even though we had $200 million to go out and buy all of this equipment, things like ventilators require storing, they require charging, they require looking after. And so in California, there was a warehouse in Palm Springs where there was a full-time team of people who would go through and periodically charge and clean and look after the machines. That cost money. It also costs money to maintain the tents and the masts and everything else and to make sure that they're up to date. So the ongoing maintenance cost for the state was something like $6 million, which I calculated it the other day, and it's something like 0.003% of the state budget. But it's $6 million. And when you're facing a massive budget deficit, the argument was, look, these things are lying around. We're not using them. We don't know if we're ever going to use them. And at the time, that was true. We didn't know that we were ever going to use them. And so the argument was made, there's no point to keep on paying to maintain this stuff. Let's just give it away to hospitals where the ventilators will be used and strip down the stockpile to its bare bones, essentially, which is exactly what California did.
Wow. Former Governor Schwarzenegger told Politico, based on your reporting, he actually criticized the short-sightedness of officials in California. He didn't name names, but we're assuming that he was talking about Governor Jerry Brown.
I mean, Jerry Brown had a horrendously difficult job to do, right? I mean, he comes into power, he's facing this massive deficit, and he has to cut corners in every way that he can, you know? And arguably, you know, cutting an emergency stockpile that's not really being used is a pretty obvious thing to do. I mean, it sort of seems to make sense. But I think Schwarzenegger, he's kind of got the best of both worlds, because he brought it in and he'd already left power when the tough decisions had to be made to get rid of it. So it's easy in retrospect to look back and say, well, hey, that's $6 million we shouldn't have cut. But ultimately, it's $6 million that had to be cut somewhere, right? So it had to be cut somewhere out of the budget. It was decided to cut it out of this. It's one of those difficult, you know, heart-wrenching decisions that politicians have to make, and increasingly have to make in California because the funding source and our taxation system is so kooky and such a mess that, you know, they had to make tough decisions, and they did, and it's now coming back to bite them. And you know, it's easy to criticize, and, you know, I think $6 million for a state like California doesn't sound like a lot of money, but we have to put it in the context of the tough decisions that Jerry Brown had to make at the time.
And what are you hearing from medical experts about this will and how, you know, governors should deal with these decisions? Because you focus on one doctor, Dr. Howard Backer, who spent years preparing California for a flu pandemic and then watched it all fall apart. You write that he worked as an emergency room physician for 25 years before becoming the state's chief medical consultant on disaster preparedness efforts. So what do people like Dr. Backer say about how the state should prepare, even when there are budget problems?
I mean, the doctors I've spoken to and the doctors that we spoke to for this project are pretty much unified. I mean, they say build your emergency stockpile and make sure that you've got it and that it's fully funded and that you're looking after it. And I would think, now, let's compare what's going on now with this pandemic to the last really huge crisis that happened in this country, or one of the last huge crises, 9/11, right? After 9/11, there was so much funding made available for making sure that terrorists couldn't attack us, basically, and for investigating and tracking down terrorists and everything else. Now, that led to all sorts of, you know, shenanigans and things that shouldn't have happened, but it also led to a lot of infrastructure and a lot of, organizations that essentially keep Americans safer. I would be amazed if we come out of this pandemic and every state and the federal government doesn't set up a very robust emergency preparedness system that's fully funded and that we're looking after and constantly maintaining. And that's what the doctors want. The doctors desperately want that because they don't want to be faced with the situation that they're in now, where they're scrambling for equipment, they're scrambling for, you know, basic things like masks and gloves. And so, I'd like to think that we're learning our lesson. It's awful that thousands of people have to die to learn that lesson, but I'm hoping that we move forward stronger as a nation and as a state and you know, learn the tough lessons that we've had to learn.
Today we're speaking with Will Carlis, correspondent for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And Will and his colleagues, Will Evans and Lance Williams, have a piece out called California Created a Massive Medical Reserve with Acute Care Beds, Ventilators, and N95 Masks, and then Let It Collapse Due to Budget Issues. You can find that piece at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions for Will, if you'd like to talk about media coverage of PPE, if you are a healthcare worker and you'd like to give us an update on what you are dealing with and seeing, and you can be anonymous, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Well, let's talk about where we are right now. Governor Newsom announced that the state of California is spending nearly $1 billion to get 200 masks a month for California's healthcare workers, all frontline workers, homeless outreach teams, grocery store clerks, all across the board. Reveal asked grocery store workers to share their stories on social media about why they're what they're going through and their working conditions. And I understand you got more than 600 responses.
Yeah, plenty more. Yeah, that's our project that we're working on at the moment. We have a story coming out on that in the next couple of days, and we had a show on that last week that your listeners can listen to as well. Yeah, and I was involved in that. Yeah.
So what really struck you about what you're hearing from workers?
Oh man, I mean, it's been really hard. It's been really eye-opening and really difficult to listen to, you know, some of the stories. So we're talking, now this is not a California-centric story. We're talking to grocery workers from across the country. But I think if I had to sum up what we're hearing, it's been a sort of a slow evolution from workers being treated on the whole very badly, and there being very little care and attention given to their health and well-being, to being treated slightly better and companies evolving policies and practices that do to some extent protect their workers. And I think probably the most stark example of that is that we spoke to dozens and dozens of people at major stores, major chains, who said, look, we were actively discouraged from wearing masks and gloves. We were told you can't do that because it's going to freak out the customers. We heard that again and again and again from all over the country. That was clearly the policy of at least some of the chains. Now, sitting here today, I think anyone who goes out to a grocery store, they're going to see the vast majority of workers are wearing masks and gloves, and they're allowed to, you know, but that took 2 or 3 weeks to come into place. It took 2 or 3 weeks for companies to relax the rules on that. You've still today got, I'm sure, thousands of grocery workers going to work right now with symptoms of COVID-19 because they simply cannot afford not to. That's their family's source of income. That's how they survive. And so they have to go to work. So it's just sort of peeling back the mask on a very fragile system we have in this country, where, you know, workers just get paid so little, they're stretched to such an extent that even if they're sick and even if it could result in spreading a deadly virus, they still have to go to work because otherwise there's not going to be any food on their tables. You know, they're not going to be able to buy the very groceries that they're stacking. So it's been extremely eye-opening and really quite troubling to hear all of these stories from all over the country.
And you can listen to that piece, Essential Workers, from Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's on our website, yourcallradio.org. I wanted to point out a piece that ran on Monday in the Washington Post, Will, by Abba Batarai. And the headline really says it all. Grocery workers are beginning to die of coronavirus. At least 4 people who worked at Walmart, Trader Joe's, and Giant have died from COVID-19 in recent days. The New York Times had a very long piece yesterday, I believe, about workers at meatpacking and slaughterhouses that are now beginning to pass. for the same reasons that you just mentioned. They have no choice but to go to work to feed their families.
I mean, look, I think, frankly, what this pandemic is really doing is it's stripping back the pretense that things are okay in this country, you know, that everything's going swimmingly because the Dow Jones, you know, because the stock markets are booming, or at least they were up until, you know, 3 weeks ago. And because, you know, a lot of people with means have a lot of money to throw around. I mean, the reality, as we've seen, is that 10% of America's workforce now doesn't have a job and is claiming unemployment. And that American workers are so stretched and living so much paycheck to paycheck that they are literally facing death and facing a horrendous virus and a horrendous death to put food on their families' tables, you know. So if that doesn't cause everybody in this country to, you know, to take a long, hard think about the system that we've got going here, I don't know what will, you know, because I've personally spoken to people over the last 2 weeks and had, you know, text and messages and signal messages and Twitter messages from people all across the country who are saying, I don't know what to do. I have to work. I have to go to work. I feel sick. I can't get out of bed, but I have to go to work because I need to get a paycheck. So, yeah. The federal bailout money, the checks that everybody's getting is especially in a state like ours. I mean, in the Bay Area, I mean, how far is $1,200 going to get you? I mean, not very far for most adults, right? So, yeah, it's a lot of people placed in really harrowing and difficult circumstances, and we're doing our best to reach out to them and tell their stories and inform the public about what's going on.
Well, I just want to read briefly from a piece in the Times. Poultry workers' death highlights spread of COVID-19 in meat plants. Sadly, Annie Grant, 55, died. She worked at Tyson. And her son, Willie Martin, a teacher in South Carolina, said, quote, "My mom said the guy at the plant said they had to work to feed America, but my mom was sick. He said he watched on his phone as his mom took her last breath." So, you know, Will, it's just so important to continue to highlight these stories, because it's sadly affecting people, like you said, who have no choice but to work. I also wanted to point out, yesterday in California, we had workers on strike who work at McDonald's, Burger King, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, a very long list of these fast food restaurants. They are demanding personal protective equipment, paid sick leave, and a $3 an hour hazard pay. And I saw a video yesterday of basically people in their cars, and they were just going in circles around a McDonald's protesting, saying, we need $3 more an hour, and we need PPE.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is kind of a nascent, just a nascent movement here. I mean, I think we're going to see workers in California, across the country, demanding better conditions, demanding better pay, demanding everything else. I mean, the flip side of it all, of course, is that if you take the grocery industry, for example, something I didn't know before I started reporting this story, grocery stores don't operate on a very high profit margin. They don't make a huge amount of money. Like, you would think that they do, but actually things are sort of screwed down so tight that they don't make huge profits, you know? So the flip side of this is, look, it's great that we can all go out and buy, you know, very cheap products. And, you know, I mentioned living in Brazil. I've lived, you know, on four continents at this point. I've lived very, you know, lots of different countries around the world. And food is cheaper in America than it is almost anywhere else. I mean, this is, people still struggle, but it is, you know, ultimately a consumer nation where stuff is pretty cheap, right? And I think that there's going to have to be a reconciliation for everybody that, you know, can we still continue to buy a pound of strawberries for $1.99, you know, if we have workers breaking their backs in fields and risking their lives, and grocery store workers risking their lives to put those products on the shelf, you know. So I think we're starting to see a sort of an overall, you know, understanding of just how tenuous the system is. But I also think it's important to note that, like, this doesn't go away when the pandemic goes away. It was there before, and it's going to be there afterwards. Like the tenuousness of those grocery store workers, the tenuousness of the lives of the fast food workers, you know, is going to be no less tenuous when the pandemic goes away. You know, and when this crisis abates somewhat, people are still going to be living on such fine margins. And, you know, I think that the country is going to have to reconcile itself with just sort of, you know, the whole thing being ripped open and people really fully seeing and understanding, like, just how difficult so many people's lives are.
And Will, final question, because we're almost out of time. The media really play a crucial role in all of this. I mean, I turn on the cable shows at night, and it's a 180 from the election season, when it was just the horse race, who's ahead, who's behind. Now you've got actual labor reporting happening on the cable shows. You've got nurses and doctors talking about PPE shortages. I mean, real issues are being discussed. You've got more labor stories, I think, than I've seen in a long time in the national media. So talk a little bit about, you know, what we should demand from the media once this is over when it comes to these very important stories.
Well, I think we all have to worry whether, you know, how much of the media is going to survive this crisis, frankly. I mean, you know, I was talking to a close friend yesterday who works at a major metropolitan newspaper. And I mean, they've been told, look, we don't know, you know, it's all corporate speak, but it's essentially, look, we're going to have to lay people off pretty soon. You're seeing organizations across the board from, you know, Tampa Bay in Florida to ProPublica, to BuzzFeed in New York to, you know, to the West Coast, you're seeing media organizations laying people off, giving people pay cuts, all the rest of it. One of the first things to go in a crisis, one of the first things that people stop spending money on is advertising, which is obviously what keeps the media afloat. So I just hope that there's still, you know, a robust media left. But to answer your question, I mean, I do think what we've seen is a kind of definitely a refocusing in the terms that you described, away from, you know, somewhat trivial matters to, I think, things, you know, really reporting on the sort of the meat and potatoes of what this country is and what's going on and the struggles that people are facing. And I think that that's overall a good thing. I think it's shaken. I think this crisis has shaken a lot of people, but it's certainly shaken a lot of reporters, you know, grabbed them by the lapels and shaken them and got them out reporting on real people and real problems. Whereas that was going on before, but I think you're right that it's going on more now than ever.
Hmm. Well, Will, thank you for reporting on real people and real problems. Really, thanks for all of your work, and our best to you and your loved ones.
Same to you guys. I hope everybody there is healthy and safe, and all your listeners too.
All right. We'll have you back soon. Thank you, Will. Take care. Will Carlos is a correspondent for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan, Damian Miner, and David Latulipe for working on today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.